existed elsewhere, you would have picked it up from a printer in London.
Of course you did.
I look up, and through the sallow glow of the lantern, our eyes meet. In this light, her skin looks bronzed, something burnished and worn into battle by ancient warriors. It would have saved you a lot of trouble.
Maybe I wanted the trouble.
There's a snap behind us as the latch of the library door clicks open.
Have a good evening,
someone calls, then the creak of hinges as it's closed again. We're out of sight, tucked between the shelves, but I can hear footsteps down the next aisle over, heading toward the fireplace. I nearly trip over myself in my haste to grab Sim and shove her out of the room. She tries to take the folio with her, but I slap it shut and shake my head. No thieving.
I'm not thieving. I'm looking,
she hisses in return.
It's not stealing, just because you take something from where it belongs.
That is the actual definition of stealing, I reply, my voice louder than I mean for it to be, for through the stacks, a man calls,
Is someone there?
I usher Sim toward the door, but she's already going, her slippers a soft tread on the rug. I straighten myself out as best I can in a dress that's mostly dessert, toss my hair back over my shoulders so I will not be tempted to nervously fuss with it, then go the opposite way, toward the firelight. Dr. Platt has taken off his wig and jacket and made a flop down in an armchair beside the mantelpiece. He kicks his feet up as he fishes in his jacket, emerging a moment later with the same snuffbox he was fiddling with when I attempted to flag him down. He tips some of the powder into a cupped hand, crushes it with his thumb, and snorts it. I have been lurking for too long to make my entrance anything less than invasive. I consider doubling back as silently as possible, and then re-entering the library, loudly, so as not to alarm him. But then he looks up, and I'm standing there, and he startles, spilling snuff down his shirt, and I startle, and suddenly I remember there's spiced wine all over my dress, and for some reason, my brain decides clarifying that point is first priority, and I blurt, This isn't blood!
God damn it!
He's brushing the snuff off his front, trying to collect it into his hand and then tip it back into the box.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
I'm so sorry. I take a step forward, as if there's anything I can do to help, but as soon as I'm properly in the firelight, he catches sight of my dress and yelps, It's just wine, I cry. I spilled wine and fell into a cake. I'm pushing my skirts behind me, like I might hide the stain from his view, but there's not much to be done about the fact that I have just snuck up on him in a dark room, and the first thing I did was assure him I'm not covered in blood. And here I thought nothing could be worse than our meeting after supper.
Do you need something?
He asks, his voice clipped. He's still trying to collect any of the spilled snuff that can be salvaged. Yes, I shouted at you earlier, in the hallway, after supper.
And now you've come to yell at me again.
He gives up on the snuff and slumps back down in his chair, running a hand over his cropped hair and looking around for something to do that will dismiss me. I'm tempted to ask him if I could excuse myself, take a good deep breath, then re-enter and try this entire encounter again, but this time with my head on straight. And, preferably, no wine spilled down my dress. I'm sorry about the snuff, I say, feeling like a kicked puppy that only wanted a pat on the head. I can replace it. He sighs, one leg bouncing up and down so that his shadow in the firelight jumps. There's a smear of it still on his lapel, and against the dark material there are flecks of incandescent blue hidden in it. It is snuff, isn't it?
It's madak, he says,
the word presented in a tone of expectation that the other party will not recognize it. But I do. That's opium and tobacco. He gives me the first proper look since I arrived. I wouldn't say he looks impressed, but he's certainly not indifferent.
From Java, yes.
There are more effective ways to take opium, I say. Medicinally speaking, dissolved in alcohol and drunk will move through the body much faster and more effectively, as it is the most direct route to the digestive system. He squints at me, and I immediately feel foolish for explaining laudanum to Alexander Platt. But instead he says,
"Who are you exactly?"
"I'm a great admirer of yours. Academically," I add quickly. "Not, I know you're getting married. Not like that. But I've read all your books, most of them, all the ones I could get. Some of them I read twice, so perhaps that makes up for the ones I missed. But I've read most. I'm Felicity Montague." I stick out my hand like he might shake it. When he makes no move to, I pretend that my intention all along was to brush something off my skirt. A large glob of dried pastry cream crumbles onto the carpet. We both look at it. I consider picking it up, but, having nothing to then do with it, I instead look back at him with a sheepish smile. To my great relief, he returns it.
"An admirer."
He pours himself a glass of whatever amber spirit is in the bottle on the mantel, then says,
"My admirers are usually much older and greyer and, well, men. They're usually men."
"Yes, sir. That's actually what I came to talk to you about. Not the men, but that I'm a woman. No, this is coming out entirely wrong." I press my hands to my stomach and force myself to take a breath so deep I swear my ridiculous stays pop. "I've been trying to gain admission to a medical school in Edinburgh, but they won't have me on account of my sex. When I made inquiries in London, I was given your name by Dr. William Cheselden." I fish around in my pocket, unwrapping the calling card from my list and handing it to him. "He said you were in London looking for a fellow, or an assistant, or something, for an expedition, and he thought you might take me on." Platt listens without interrupting, which I appreciate. But he also keeps his face entirely unreadable, which I appreciate less, as I'm unsure what effect my speech is having upon him and whether I should press on with it, until he says,
"I'm not sure where Cheselden got the impression I was looking for a fellow, but I'm not."
Oh. All the breath leaves my lungs in that single exhalation, and yet it still comes out very small. I have to look down at my feet to make certain I'm still standing and not on my knees, for the world feels to have dropped away from me so suddenly it's like falling. I've never felt so foolish in my whole life, not being thrown from the university in Scotland, or standing before the governors in London, or when my mother presented me with enrolment in finishing school, like she was making all my dreams for education come true. I've come all this way. I've bargained and begged and compromised so much. I didn't realise how much hope I had pinned to this moment, and how little I had truly let myself consider the possibility of defeat, until it snuffed me out like a candle. My whole world reformed in a second by the dashing of a hope I have not just lived with, but lived inside. My collapse must be more obvious than I hoped, for Platt turns Cheselden's card over between his fingers, then says,
"You really came all the way here to ask me about a position?"
"Yes," I say, my voice just as small and just as kinked up with disappointment as before. I swipe the heel of my hand against my cheek, then add, "And I know Joanna. I'm not here entirely under pretense." Platt's glass halts at his lips.
"You do?"
"We were friends when we were children," I explain. "We grew up together."
"In England. What did you say your name was?"
"Felicity Montague." He takes a sip of the whiskey, regarding me over the rim, then hooks his foot around a stool and pulls it in front of him.
"Come sit down."
I take a tentative seat, and he tips his glass at me.
"Care for a drink?"
When I shake my head, he takes another sip and says,
"Why do you want to study medicine, Miss Montague? It's not a passion one sees in many young ladies.
I may not have gotten to use my answers on the St. Bart's board, but I've got them ready. I reach into my pocket before I can stop myself and pull out that battered list, now folded and unfolded so many times in varying states of dampness that I can hardly read the words overlapping the creases. First, I start, but Platt cuts me off.
What's that? Do you have to read off a paper to remember your own heart?
I raise my head. Oh, no, sir. I just had this prepared for...
Give it here. Let me see.
He holds out a hand, and I surrender my list, biting back the temptation to snatch it back in embarrassment of both my penmanship and earnestness. Platt scans the list with a loud sip from his glass. Then he sets both glass and list upon the end table and begins fishing in his coat pocket.
None of this will get you taken seriously by physicians in London.
Sir?
All this nonsense about women contributing to the field. No one will listen to that argument. Don't even mention you're a woman. No one wants to hear about women. Act as though it's no barrier and that you, as you so appropriately say, deserve to be here.
He finds a pencil nub in his jacket and crosses out my first point. I feel an actual lurch in my stomach when his pencil makes violent contact with the paper, like he's scrubbing out part of my soul.
And while I appreciate the naming here, so what if you can read and write Latin, French and German? Any idiot with an Eton education can do more. They don't want to hear that. They want to see it in the way you carry yourself, the way you speak.
He makes a note, then his eyes flip down the list. One brow arching.
Did you really mend an amputated finger?
Yes, sir, my friend.
Lead in with that, he interrupts, scrawling the point at the top of my paper. Experience is everything. Say it is one of many instances, even if it is not, and tell them you'll work for free and harder than anyone else, even if it isn't true. None of this nonsense about lady surgeons in history. You can't name a lady surgeon from history because there aren't any that matter to these men. You need to talk about Paracelsus and Antonio Benevieni and Galen.
Galen? I laugh before I can help it, then immediately clap my hands over my mouth, horrified that I have just laughed in the face of Dr. Alexander Platt. But he looks up from my paper with a curious expression, and I press on. He's a man who wrote about the body without ever making an actual study of one. Half his theories were disproved by Vesalius, and no one even took the time to prove the rest wrong because they're so obviously idiotic. Paracelsus burned his books. Who reads Galen anymore?
Clearly not you.
Platt presses his fingers together, my paper between them.
You favour human dissection, then?
Strongly, I reply, though particularly when that dissection is used in conjunction with your school of discovering the cause rather than the cure.
Ha! I didn't know anyone thought of it as a school.
He makes another note on my paper.
Had you been granted hospital education, you would have found my theories as disregarded as Galen's.
Prevention would decrease the business of hospitals and make it more difficult for them to exploit the poor, so I understand why they will not invest in it, with all due respect to the hospital boards in London. I pause, then add, actually, no. No respect is due to them, because they're all asses. He stares at me, and I fear I've spoken too boldly. But then he laughs, a burst like a bullet through glass.
No wonder those toffs in London didn't like you. Where did you find all these opinions?
I didn't find them. I formulated them, I say, from reading your books. And others. He leans forward, elbows on his knees, and I'm suddenly very aware of the fact that it's just the pair of us, talking alone in a library at night, which sounds far more like a scene from the amateur novels I used to pretend to read than the medical texts I was actually studying. Platt wipes the corner of his mouth with his thumb.
You're lucky the hospitals didn't admit you. You'd be better off getting a venereal disease instead of a practical education. They'll both make you unsuitable for jobs and undesirable to men.
He looks at me like he's expecting me to laugh at that, but the best I can offer is not frowning. Perhaps I have placed too much hope in Dr. Platt being entirely divorced from the notion of a woman's primary value being how much she's desired.
The hospital schools in London are populated by the sons of rich men whose fathers pay for them to sleep through their lectures and skip hospital rounds, he goes on, and then buy their way into the guilds. You would have been wasted there.
Then what would you suggest I do? I ask. He drains his glass, then sets it hard on the desk, like the end of a toast.
You take my suggestions, and you improve your arguments, and you try your petition with someone who would actually have something to teach you. Go to Padua, or Geneva, or Amsterdam. They're more forward-thinking than we English.
He returns my list to me, and I look down at his scribbled notes in the margins, his handwriting only slightly worse than mine. Platt is already settling back into his chair, pulling a foot up under him, and reaching again for the bottle. And this may be the only chance I ever get. So I clear my throat, bit of a dramatic gesture, and start. Well then, sir, I would like to make a petition to you for a position. He looks up, but I press forward before he can tell me this was not what he meant. You may not be looking for an assistant, but you will not know how badly you were wanting for one until I begin. You will wonder how you ever got by without me. I will work harder than any other student you may have had, because this opportunity would be too precious to me to waste. I already have some practical knowledge, having completed successful surgical procedures on multiple occasions under situations of duress, in addition to the knowledge I have gained from reading books, such as Antonio Bienvieni's De Abditus Morborum Causis, both of which will provide a strong foundation to be built upon. I am a supporter of human dissection and anatomical studies, which align well with the school you practice, and I believe that my contributions to your work, as well as the knowledge you could provide for me, would leave us both better for our partnership. I take a deep breath. It shakes a little more than I'd like. Platt hasn't said a word the whole time I was speaking, nor did he try to interrupt me. He kept his head tipped to the side, swirling his empty glass between his thumb and first finger. But when I pause for that breath, he says,
"Are you finished?"
I'm not sure if that's an invitation to continue or a request to stop, so I just reply, "For now."
"Well then."
He nods once.
"Bravo."
"Really?"
"It's not the best argument I've heard, but you're certainly fearless. I mean, my God, you came all the way here just to see me, and you're willing to learn. That's the most important thing."
He rubs his palms together like he's trying to warm them, or perhaps scheming. It's hard to say. Then he asks,
"Will you be at the Polterabend?"
"The what?"
"It's another one of the insane wedding customs here. Friends all come in fancy dress in the theme of fish and fowl the night before the wedding and smash pottery. Scherben bringen Glück, shards bring luck, that's the saying. It's all a waste of time and good china, but the bride must be appeased. Will you be there?"
I don't love the way he speaks of Joanna. I also don't say yes, in case his next sentence was going to be an offer to skip the society party with him and instead bury ourselves up to our eyeballs in medical texts. "If I'm invited..."
"I'm inviting you."
He leans into a luxurious stretch, arms over his head, his back arched, before he reaches again for his snuffbox.
"We should find each other there and have a chat. I'm going to Heidelberg tomorrow to pick up a prescription, and I won't be back until the party. But I'll think while I'm gone over where a mind like yours might be best put to use."
I don't want to say no, but also I don't want to wait. I don't want to talk to him the night before his wedding. His attention will be split between too many things, and that's not enough time for any position to be secured before he departs. And there's no such thing as a substantial conversation at a party. Dr. Cheselden mentioned you're going to the Barbary States, I venture, and he nods. Are you leaving soon?
After the wedding. Miss Hoffman and I are honeymooning in Zurich for a week, and then I'll depart from Nice.
Zurich? How... I fumble for a word. It is not the ideal location for a romantic post-nuptial retreat. Cold?
Not so cold, and not for long. I'll be on the Mediterranean by the first of the month, and Miss Hoffman on her way to my home in London.
Do you think there might be a place, I venture, but he cuts me off.
My crew is already set. The work we're undertaking is quite sensitive, so the ranks have to be monitored rather judiciously.
Of course. He snaps the snuff box open and shut a few times, staring down into it like he's thinking hard.
But come find me at the Polterabend. We'll talk more. I promise.
I don't quite know what that means, other than I now need to make certain I have a dress for the night that is not decorated with tonight's dessert. As though he read my thoughts, Platt looks me up and down and laughs.
I'm a little disappointed it isn't blood your dress is covered in. I would quite like to see a lady surgeon at her post.
And that recognition, in spite of the irksome modifier, that pride and belief in his voice, where usually I only find scorn, makes me feel seen, for perhaps the first time in my life. 9. I can hear the Polterabend carrying up the stairs and through my bedroom door, so grand and sparkling that it spooks me before I've seen the source. I would have had a book tucked into my skirt, and am truly still considering it, or chosen to not attend at all, had it not been for Dr. Platt's invitation to talk more at the party. Since our meeting in the library, he's been absent from the house, only returning a few hours earlier and immediately being swept off by Herr Hoffman to make himself ready. And with the ceremony tomorrow, this is a precious final chance to speak with him. Sim manifested another dress from the modiste in Stuttgart, this one with a far more appropriate waistline for my square torso, but made from a shiny black crepe that strongly suggests it was meant for a funeral. That, and its ready-made nature. Death is even more unpredictable than sitting in a cake at a party. It's not on the appointed theme of fish and fowl, but I could make a good argument for the entomological nature of my outfit, for I feel like a beetle in this skirt, the material made stiff and wide by panniers and thin ribbons dangling off the waist like antennae. "I think you tied it wrong," I said at least 5 times to Sim while she helped me dress, and each time she replied,
"I have not tied it wrong."
I am still contemplating as I stand alone in my room, teetering before the mirror, trying not to be self-conscious about the fact that my hair is up off my neck and that I have several very large spots on my chin, and also absolutely maddened by the fact that I care about these things when Dr. Platt is waiting for me downstairs. "Your beauty is not a tax you are required to pay to take up space in this world," I remind myself, and my hand flits unconsciously to my pocket, where my list is still tucked. "You deserve to be here." Someone knocks on my bedroom door, a frantic rap that's certainly not Sim's tap of warning before she lets herself in each time.
"Felicity?"
comes hissed over the knock.
"Felicity, are you there? Joanna?"
The door flies open, and she comes scampering into the room without invitation, Max bounding at her heels like they're about to have a romp. She's dressed for the party, white powder, perfect pink cheeks, and a heart-shaped mouche placed with surgical precision on her left cheek. Tiny pearls drip down her neck, spilling over the elegant slope of her shoulders and in between her breasts. She slams the door behind her, Max perching himself at her feet, with his tail thumping the floor hard enough to rattle the window panes.
"I need your help," she says,
breathless, and I realise that the colour in her cheeks isn't from rouge. My help? I'm still shocked she didn't throw me out of her home after my scene at the party. What do you need my help with? I've ruined my dress. She turns around, trying to see her own back like a dog chasing its tail, and Max mimics with foamy delight. Look! It's a tent's worth of material, and so adorned I can't see anything amiss at first. I peer at her, trying to find the rip or tear or the big spot of drool from the dog. On the back, she says, and I fight my way around the skirt as she keeps turning. And there it is, a small, but very noticeable, against the blue, spot of blood. I didn't realise I had started until I put the dress on, Joanna moans. Max lets out a low yowl in solidarity. It's impossible to have an interest in medicine without picking up several methods for removing bloodstains along the way. It is also impossible to be a woman without that knowledge, though Joanna is limited by its location. I think I can get this out, I say. Can you really? Stay here. I dash into my dressing room and fish out a fingerful of talc from its silver casing, then mix it with a few drops of water from the wash basin before returning to her. I press the salve carefully into the stain, then fan it with my hand. It has to dry, I explain, when she casts me a quizzical glance over her shoulder. And who can blame her? I'm currently waving at her backside while Max dances delightedly between us, like this is some sort of fantastic game, his jowls swinging. What if it doesn't work? Joanna asks, her hands pressed to either side of her neck. Then I'll throw a glass of wine at you to cover it up, and you can tell everyone the stain was my fault. I had quite a lot of practice the other night. I thought I did a rather good job of making light of the incident, but Joanna doesn't laugh. She puts her chin to her shoulder, eyes downcast. You could have just told me you were miserable, instead of destroying the dessert table. I stop flapping. In my defence, I didn't mean to do that. And also in my defence, I have no other defence. I'm sorry I ruined your party. Oh, you hardly ruined it. One can still have a marvellous party without desserts, though they certainly help. It is exceedingly odd to converse with someone while standing behind them, but facing Joanna, looking her in the eyes, still feels too daunting. Too easy to see the way she has settled into herself like an impression in the sand, while I have just grown stranger. I stare at the clasp of her necklace and the fine hairs that curl along the back of her neck. I wouldn't know. Why? Because you've never been to a party? No, I have. I know. I meant, caring about things like parties is beneath a woman like you. I didn't say that. Well, not just now, no. She turns. Makes me look at her. But you did. Once. She's speaking gently. Not a thorn could grow from that sprightly voice. But something about it makes me want to snap back at her. And you said I was an ugly shrew and would die alone. She takes a step backward. I didn't. It may not have been exactly those words, I say, but you made it very clear you thought me less of a woman because I don't care about balls and card parties and boys and ridiculous blue dresses. She folds her arms. Well, you seem to think I was less of a person because I did. Well, you're certainly a less interesting person now than you were. I want to take it back as soon as I say it, or better yet, want to go back and try this conversation again and not say it at all. Or maybe go back even further and never fight with her. Because I used to know Joanna like she was another version of myself. I had forgotten just how intimate our friendship was until I saw her again. The hollow spaces in my shadow, the second set of footsteps beside mine. I could have listed her favourite foods, animals, plants, books, in preferential order like I had memorised them out of an encyclopaedia. We made up a song about the four humours before I stopped taking Galen seriously as a medical writer. We got poison oak from hiking along the River Dee, looking for sea monsters, and didn't tell anyone for fear of being kept apart. But standing beside her now, it doesn't feel the same. It likely never will. Returning to a place you once knew as well as your own shadow isn't the same as never leaving at all. I'm sorry, I start. I shouldn't have said. It's not a blue dress. It's indigo, she interrupts. I chose this shade because it comes from Persicaria tinctoria, which is a flower, like buckwheat, that my mother collected while she was in Japan and brought back to Amsterdam for cultivation. We stare at each other, the silence between us thick and fragile. Hearing that Latin classification from her lips is like a melody from childhood, half remembered and suddenly played in full. Things I did not know had been askew fall back into place inside me. I miss you, I want to say. I think the talc is dry, I say instead. The talc has turned a faint brown, and it crumbles like plaster when I scrape it off with my fingernail. Max pushes his nose into the discarded chunks until Joanna hisses at him that he is a filthy creature and absolutely should not eat that. He does not seem particularly deterred. Did it work? She asks, hands pressed over her eyes. I heft the not inconsiderable amount of material into my arms and stretch the offending patch between my hands for an examination. It's not entirely gone, but if you don't know it's there, you can't hardly tell. Promise? I'm trusting you because I can't see it. You can trust me, I falter. The fabric of her dress suddenly feels slick as buttered glass between my hands. I didn't know your mother was in Japan. Joanna tugs on her necklace, pulling the clasp back into place. She was quite a lot of places. When she died... She died, I interrupt, the words coming out in a sharp breath. When? Last year, near Algiers. Joanna, I'm so sorry. She shrugs. I never really knew her. The live that hums behind the words like a hive. I did not know much of Joanna's mother. I never met her, except that she had left an abysmal marriage and was away, in Japan, apparently. And when Joanna's father died, her mother would not or could not come home for her daughter. That had been the story that had been passed down the church pews and through tea parties and over card games until it finally reached me, because she was gone from my life by then. Sent away to a relation in Bavaria because her mother didn't want her. Would you like a hug? I ask. She frowns at me. You hate hugs. Right, but I could make an exception, if it would help you. How about instead? She offers me a hand, and when I take it, squeezes gently, the same way we used to when we helped each other up rocks and fallen trees, so we knew the other had a grip. We knew we had a hold of each other. We could step more boldly than we would without a mooring. Then Max, ever the jealous lover, sticks his nose between our hands until we use them instead to scratch his head. Joanna and I leave my room together, Max prancing behind us like a show pony. The bow around his neck seems to make him feel very pretty. At the top of the stairs, we nearly smash into Joanna's uncle, who is making a very dramatic ascent with a lot of huffing and muttered curses. Joanna! He snaps when he sees us. Where have you been? Joanna halts, reaching out for Max's head. I was... All of these insane festivities are for you. And here he shakes his hands in the general direction of the still unseen party. And you can't even be bothered to show up on time. Do you know how much I wasted on flowers alone? It's the middle of the winter, and you insist on lilies. I had a problem with my dress, I interrupt, for Joanna looks like she may start to cry, and I don't want to add ruined cosmetics to the list of this evening's fashion catastrophes. Miss Hoffman was helping me. You have a maid for such things. The uncle takes Joanna's arm with a grip that looks like it pinches and starts to drag her away, but then pivots back to me for a last word.
Miss Montagu, is it? While we're on the subject, you'd best keep a closer eye upon that maid. I chased her out of my study this morning.
What?
The hair on the back of my neck stands up. I didn't see Sim much this morning, but I have also been so preoccupied with reviewing Alexander Platt's treatises so that I could be best prepared for our conversation tonight.
What was she doing there?
Lord knows. I gave her a slap and a scold to stay where she was allowed.
Sim hadn't mentioned that. She hadn't given any sign of taking a hit. But then I suppose Monty never had either, and he was beaten by our father for years. Or perhaps it's just easy not to see if you aren't looking. Herr Hoffmann adjusts his wig, the part down the middle a pale line like a surgical thread pulled taut.
I suggest you not employ negresses, madam. They're slippery and treacherous.
That's a very grand statement, I reply.
If you had worked with as many African sailors as I have, you'd be suspicious as well.
I start, thinking for a moment he knows Sim is a sailor, before I realize he's talking about his shipping company.
Come along, Joanna.
Joanna casts me an apologetic look over her shoulder as her uncle drags her away.
What about Max?
I'll put him in your room, I say quickly, for her uncle looks ready to strike her as well, were they not about to walk into polite company.
I hook two fingers under the bow around Max's neck, then realize that is hardly enough, and instead use both my hands to tug him back to my side. He whines, claws pulling up the rug as Joanna and her uncle disappear down the stairs.
Go with Felicity, Joanna calls.
Max only cries louder.
Come on, you enormous wrinkle.
I heave so hard I hear my shoulder joint pop. Max responds by lying down, a dead weight made possible to drag only by the fact that his fur is very slippery upon the polished wood floor. But I am not dragging this reluctantly dragged behemoth anywhere, particularly because, in the process, he is leaving enough hair behind that two other dogs could be fashioned from it.
Max!
I let go of the bow and instead make a fist, which I hold out to him. What if I told you I had a treat for you in this hand? He sits up at once, tail thumping and all abandonment forgotten, then stands and follows me as I back down the hallway. I lead him into Joanna's room, then open my hand and let his nose, the size of my palm, make a thorough exploration to be certain there's nothing there. The thought of food got him salivating, and when he snorts and pulls his snout away, my hands are thick with slimy drool. The whole affair is a bit like being lovingly caressed by a dead fish. I'm about to go when Max lets out a low woof, more threat to it than I've heard from him before. I turn back from the doorway as Max growls again. Sim is standing at Joanna's writing desk, the drawers open and their contents strewn over the top. She has a ring of thin files looped around one thumb, the metal picks clinking against each other like coins. Her sleeves are pushed up past her elbows, and I get a flash of that pirate ink in the crook of her elbow, a dagger running parallel to her veins, capped by a crown. I have interrupted a burglary. Sim must have frozen when I opened the door, for we stare at each other from across the room. I wonder if she's armed, that marlin spike or worse within her reach. I wonder if I should run. But I've seen her, and she's seen me, and she knows where I sleep. Running won't change any of that. Max lets out another ominous woof from deep within his chest. If there is to be a fight, at least I have the heaviest thing in the room on my side. Sim, what are you doing? I say, trying to keep my voice as low and even as I can, though I'm reaching for the doorknob behind my back. She doesn't answer. The hard line of her jaw pops as she grinds her teeth. Are you stealing from the Hoffmans? Is that why you came here? You fed me nonsense about that book so that I wouldn't notice you were a thief.
Let me explain,
she says, but I don't give her a chance. Behind my back, my hand finds the door latch, and I spin around, trying to throw it open and bolt, only to find Max's not insignificant rump is entirely in my way. The door bounces straight off him and slams again. Sim launches herself across the room and grabs me, trying to pull me back into the room and away from the door. I have no idea what she intends to do once she has me where she wants me, so I take an example from Max and throw my dead weight in opposition. Instead of trying to pull me up, she tackles me, launching me backward so that we both smash into the wardrobe hard enough that it rattles against the wall. Inside, I hear something fall off a shelf and shatter, and the noxious scent of spilled rosewater blooms around us, so thick we both cough. Sim's scrabbling behind me, trying to keep me pinned and reach the desk as well, and I'm almost sure she's groping for some sort of weapon. While I don't know much about fighting, I do know how revolting drool is, so I reach up and clap her face between my hands, still thick with Max's saliva. She yanks away from me. God, what is that? That's disgusting. I take a great lungful of air, ready to shout thief, but Sim leaps again, this time toward the desk. She snatches a single letter off it, the seal cracked in half and its folds fluttering, then bolts for the door. I seize her by the back of the dress and yank hard. There's a ripping sound as her skirt tears away from her waistband. She seems willing to leave her modesty behind if it means escaping. She's still pulling for the door, so I adjust my grip and instead fasten my arms around her waist, and we both crash to the ground again. There's another ripping sound as we fall, this one from my dress, and I feel my mannish shoulders break through the stitching where the sleeves connect to the bodice. Max is barking. He's also dancing around us with his haunches in the air and his front paws upon the ground like this is a game, cementing his status as the least effective guard dog of all time. We had a deal, I say to Sim, my words coming out in short, sharp gasps. Nothing! Stolen! Let go of me! Sim is trying to claw her way to the doorway on her stomach, but I'm still attached to her waist and doing my best to snatch that letter from her. I manage to get my hands around one end and I pull, hoping it might come free, but instead it rips. I'm thrown backward, half the letter, including the seal, crumpled and slobbery in my hand. Sim's chin cracks the ground hard, but she's up so fast it seems like she bounced. I'm still dazed from the fall as she opens the bedroom door and slips out. I sit up, immediately greeted by a hard butt on the forehead from Max, who still thinks this romp is for his entertainment. I push him off, struggling to my feet, and smooth the scrap of my letter out against my dress. Between my damp hands, violent grip, and the fact that I am in possession of only half of it, the letter is entirely unreadable. But the seal has held well enough that I can make out the words, Kunstkammer Staub, Zurich. I don't know what else she would have taken had I not walked in on her, but she was taking things. She is a thief. I let a thief into Joanna's house. Doesn't matter what she's after or what she wants. I brought her here. From the moment she pulled the marlinspike on the sailor in London, perhaps even sooner, a part of me suspected it. But the bigger part of me ignored that entirely. She could have told me from the first word that she was here to slit someone's throat in the dead of night, and I likely would have gone along with it because I would have turned a blind eye to anything for the chance to meet Alexander Platt. Primum non nocera, first do no harm, that's the oath. I can't start down a path with those words in hand, knowing that I stepped on Joanna to get there. I need to warn her. I was a fool to bring Sim here. A fool to think she'd hold up her end of a hollow promise. But ambition can infect your sensibilities and poison them like a well. There's a reason most geniuses have failed marriages and no friends. I leave Max in the room and dash down the stairs. The Polterabend is spilling outside from the grand parlour in the back of the house. There are tables stacked with china to be ceremonially smashed, guests retrieving their dishes to be broken upon the stones outside. There is an excess of lamps to illuminate the cards and dice being played around the room, though hands are starting to be dropped and parties shuffled outside toward the traditional smashing, now that the bride has arrived. There's a quartet playing in one corner. The violinist has legs too long for the small stool he's been confined to, and they're folded under him at an awkward crimp, one foot twisted almost impossibly around for balance, like an unstrung marionette that has landed in a tangle. I think of Percy, and suddenly want to be home so much it hurts. Or not home so much as... I don't know what I'm missing. It's a queer thing to have a vacant space inside you, and not know what it is that carved out that absence. There's the crash of a dish prematurely broken out on the veranda, and a few people begin to howl with laughter. I follow the sound into the night, feeling so hot a cloak would have been redundant until the winter air gets its teeth in me and I shiver. Above me, the sky is murky with clouds, stars scattered between them like seashells on a beach. On the veranda, everyone is wrapped in furs and velvet, some of them masked with feathers and scales painted or pasted over the frame. Others have the same feathers and scales pressed straight onto their faces like pox patches. Women have whole birds in their hair, wings attached to the sleeves of their dresses or the hems of their cloaks. The servants, carrying lanterns, are dressed in black feathers so that the lights look like they're floating. The light flashes off the pottery everyone is holding, glazed and shimmering like cupped fireflies between their hands. Everything feels overwrought and overdrawn, too bright and too loud and too disorienting. No one looks like themselves, or even truly human. I should be looking for Platt. He asked me to be here, told me he wanted to talk about my work and study. I should be thinking of myself and my future and my career. But all I want to do is find Joanna. I spot her talking to a man with octopus tentacles woven into his wig and a wine glass in each hand. In the silvery light of the lamps on the snow, she looks like a mermaid or the figurehead of a ship, the sort of plump, heavenly siren that would have sailors throwing themselves into the sea at just a crook of her finger. The feathers sewn onto her dress move slowly in the breeze, like kelp underwater. And when she turns toward the faint light spilling from the house and tussling with the stars, the powder on her skin makes her cheeks sparkle. She shrieks with delight when she sees me coming, like this is the first time we've seen each other all night, or perhaps simply as an excuse to abandon the man trying to force one of the glasses upon her, and holds out a hand for me to take.
"Felicity, I've been looking for you. I'm sorry I left you with the dog. He didn't give you any trouble, did he? Oh, no. What happened to your dress?"
I pull the wilted sleeve up over my shoulder. It slips down again at once.
"I need to talk to you," I say. "Alone." "All right. I'll be back, my lord. Don't make a move until I return."
She taps the geriatric Kraken's nose with her fan, then lets me drag her away, up onto the porch and out of the circle of lantern light.
"Do you think it looks all right?" she says as we go,
trying to turn to get a look at the back of her dress.
"I don't think anyone can tell, but I can't stop worrying about it."
I halt so abruptly, she steps on the heel of my shoe, and I almost stumble out of it.
"What is it? What's wrong?"
If I tell her, there will likely be no chance of working with Platt. What respectable physician would hire an outsider who had used devious means to gain access to him, lied her way into his home, and left his fiancée vulnerable to robbery? But it's Joanna beaming down at me, and all I say is, "I'm sorry." My voice comes out as thin as smoke. A small crease appears between her eyebrows, the only blemish upon her face.
What are you sorry for? You did such a good thing for me earlier.
No, I have to tell you something.
Can it wait? I have to...
No, stop. Just stop talking, please, and listen to me. I take her hands, and she stills, her mouth pulling down into a frown. The girl with me, Sim, she's not my maid. She's, I don't know, a sailor, maybe associated with bad people. She was looking at a book in your library, and your uncle caught her in his study, and I found her just now in your apartments, robbing you, and she tried to make off with this. I press the letter into her palms. Joanna stares at me, then down at the letter. Her thumb traces the outline of the wax seal.
You're a thief?
No, my maid is. She's not my maid. She paid my way here in exchange for getting her into your house. I only came because I wanted to talk to Dr. Platt about a job. I'm not going to school. I'm not in touch with my family. I've been in Edinburgh for a year trying to get a medical education, and no one will have me, and if I don't find work soon, I don't know what I'll do. I thought Dr. Platt could help me.
You lied to me.
Yes. Yes, I did. I'm absolutely clutching at her hands, like that will keep her from leaving me without atonement. The scrap of the stolen letter crumples between us. But I'm telling you now.
You think that matters, she says,
her already trilling voice rising to a whistle tone.
You're telling me after I've been robbed, after you let this person into my home, after you let her into my rooms.
She told me she wasn't here to steal anything.
And you believed her, she demands. Better question. Why did you ally yourself with someone who had to make a clarifying point that she was not a thief? What did you think she was doing here? What did you think she wanted with me?
I can't even look at her. I comb back through my interactions with Sim. Every moment from that first time we sat down in the pub. And I know Joanna's right. I assumed the best, even while I told myself I was being suspicious and careful enough, because more than Joanna's safety, more than any real concern for what Sim was doing, I was thinking of myself. I had to talk to Dr. Platt, I tell her. You don't understand what it's like to be so stuck you'll do anything to get out. She pulls in her lips, bites her cheeks, squeezes my hand.
Don't I?
It's that moment that Dr. Platt himself, as though summoned, appears at her side, one hand fastening around her elbow.
Joanna, where have you been? Your uncle is looking for you.
He spots me, attached to her wrists, and smiles.
Miss Montague, good evening. I was beginning to think you'd forgotten me.
His smile flips as he stares at my shoulder, and I realize one of my sleeves has puddled in the crook of my elbow.
Is your dress torn, or is that the fashion these days?
I look between Joanna and Platt, mute. I think for certain she'll tell him about what I've done, out me as the ambitious monster that I am. But instead, she presses the scrap of the letter back into my hand and folds my fingers over it before turning to Dr. Platt.
I'm ready, if you and Uncle are, she says.
And suddenly she's herself again, an actress composing herself before she steps on stage and becomes someone else.
Let's get on with it, then. May I?
He asks, and I realize I'm still holding Joanna's hands. Or perhaps Joanna is holding mine. When she lets go, she leaves behind small half-moons on my knuckles from where her fingernails bit, and that damp, withered scrap of paper, the waxy seal starting to go soft from so much handling. Anger rises in me as I watch them walk away, blotting out the guilt and panic like sand over ink. I'm not sure if she doesn't believe me, or simply doesn't want to believe me. And why didn't she tell Platt or show him whatever correspondence was snatched, Or at least tell someone so that everyone in the house is ready to tackle Sim if they see her. I watch Joanna and Platt descend the stairs, meeting her uncle halfway. He hands them each a plate, then raises his hand to the courtyard and calls for silence. The musicians break off. The crowd hushes. Hoffman looks to Platt, who clears his throat and steps forward, letting Joanna's arm fall from his.
"We're so happy," he says, though his voice sounds flat and rehearsed. "You are all here to celebrate with us. I'm very lucky to have formed a partnership with the Hoffmans."
He nods to the uncle, then seems to remember this is actually meant to be about Joanna, and adds,
"And lucky as well to have found a woman who will tolerate a mad doctor for a husband."
There are a few laughs. I swear Joanna looks back at where I'm standing, and she looks like she wants to run.
"If you'll please join me."
Platt looks to Joanna's uncle, who has a fixed smile while his face goes slowly red. What was likely supposed to be a grand speech from the groom was a mere two lines. But Platt raises his plate in the air, then reaches behind him and grabs Joanna's hand, pulling her to his side.
"Sherbin bringin gluck!"
Joanna raises her plate, and the guests raise theirs, and they fling them to the ground, where they burst, shards streaking through the air like comets as they catch the lantern light. The air turns dusty with china plaster, a thin haze hovering over the evening and turning the barrels of light foggy with motes. There are screams of delight and laughter, and music begins to play as dishes are thrown, toppled, flung, and stepped upon. Every one of them smashed.
10.
Joanna disappears almost as soon as the china is broken, and I don't dare approach Dr. Platt. If she told him about Sim, and who could blame her, to assure there would be no chance of me entering their lives after I had gone on and on about how I had put her in danger just to meet Platt, any hope I had of working with him, or any connections he might have provided, will be snuffed. He may be a rebel in the operating room, but I imagine offering the new bride up to a robber will put a permanent tarnish on a relationship. I return to my room to find Sim's knapsack gone, which is part relief, part dread, because with her goes my way back to England. I wrangle myself out of my dress, more rip myself out, for it's already beyond saving, and change into the weathered tartan skirt and bodice I arrived in. There is no point staying for the wedding now. Joanna will want nothing to do with me. She'll likely turn Platt against me. I'm not certain how I'll travel back to England. Perhaps on credit, then show up on Callum's doorstep and accept his proposal, so long as he takes on the massive debt I have mustered in returning to him. Perhaps I'll go back to London and try again. Perhaps I should take up factory work and hope that someone's foot gets sucked into a machine occasionally, and I have the chance to practice what I've spent so much time studying. Perhaps I should go back to my parents, tail tucked, and give it all up. But it feels like living without a heart. Until now, I was chasing something, no matter how far in the distance it was. But now, my only choice is going back. And going back means resigning myself to a life without work, without study or purpose. And what kind of life is that? Perhaps, like walking with a lamp in the dark, I must move forward before I am able to see the next bend in the road. But for now, I pack my things, then sit on the bed and wait for the sun to pearl along the horizon, feeling trapped within a shrinking box in an indifferent universe. The first noise I hear does not come from the house, raising its head in preparation for a wedding, but rather from the grounds outside. Someone is whistling. Then a child's voice cries in German,
"Come on, doggy, run!"
I stand and cross to the window. The sky is peach-coloured outside my window, the pine trees dark blades in silhouette against it. On the lawn, blanketed in snow, still studded with flecks of broken china, a tiny girl with shocking blonde hair and enormous ears is running circles around Matt.